I'd like to welcome everyone to our, I don't know, 7th, 8th session, something like that. Anybody counting? 7th, 8th session on Kierkegaard's corrective. Today we're going to look at the fourth dimension of what I see going on in this corrective in Kierkegaard's later writings, calling it an ontological corrective. That's a little highfalutin, but... What I'm looking at there is another wedge that Kierkegaard is driving in between the Christian faith and community. Now, we've been identifying about four wedges now that Kierkegaard's been driving in. The first wedge that he drove was to try to separate the Christian faith from comfort and consolation, seeing in his day a collapse that the Christian faith is identical with the offer of comfort. And instead trying to spread those apart a little bit, not hacksaw them apart so that there's no comfort whatsoever, but that it becomes a minor issue, a subordinate issue. And what was more important for him than comfort was danger, a life of danger and disruption. Okay. Then the second wedge that we looked at was a wedge that he drove in between the Christian faith and morality. He saw in his time... In Copenhagen, Denmark, 1813 to 1855, when he lived, this collapse as well there, that to be a Christian was to be a moral person. And he wanted to drive a wedge in between morality and Christianity so that while morality is important for the Christian, it's not the dominant thing. He said there's a higher calling. At times he said there's a higher morality. Kind of a funny way to operate there. But the book where he elaborates that is called Fear and Trembling. So again, the wedge that's driven in between the Christian faith and comfort is very much like the wedge that's driven in between the Christian faith and morality. If you no longer can say, well, gosh, following Jesus may be nuttier than ever, but at least I'm doing some things that are good. We give money to the food bank. We build hospitals. Oh, yes, your credibility is starting to come back. No, I don't want that. I don't want you to have that kind of credibility. I want you to feel like you're standing out there all alone in fear and trembling, not having any ethical system there to bolster you up, not having any categorical imperative, any ought. You know, I'm doing what I ought to do. Don't you think this is what one ought to do? Build hospitals? Care for those who are sick? Yes, it is. Thank you. Thank you. I have some credibility now. Kierkegaard's very worried about getting credibility for the wrong thing. There's credibility in being moral, but that is not the credibility a Christian should have. Because then your security lies where it shouldn't. He wants the security to lie in the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And in order to have that, you've got to experience this fear and trembling, being willing to run the risk, someone saying, you are immoral, and I think it's because you're a Christian. Okay, then the third wedge that we saw being driven, called an epistemological corrective, but that wedge was a wedge driven between the Christian faith and knowledge. In his time, he saw a collapse happening there as well. That to be a Christian was to know certain things. To know certain things. I know there's some Christian circles today, you know, they talk about perfect knowledge, and there's a lot of talk about knowledge. In his day, I think it was more a complaint that he saw emanating from the bishops of the church, all that they knew, and the professors at the universities, all that they knew. And in order to be a Christian, what you needed to have was the correct knowledge. If one was floundering in the faith or their Christian identity was suspect, it could well be because they didn't know enough. He had this this worry, as well as one not only attacking the bishops and the professors, but I think there was also maybe a more vicious in Kirkor, a more vicious concern with doctrine. Very worried about the place that doctrine has in the life of the Christian. The assumption seemed to be, as he was viewing it, that the Christian is the one who holds all the correct doctrines. Want to find out if somebody's a Christian? Ask them if they believe in the virginal conception of Jesus Christ. It's a litmus test, isn't it? I preached a sermon one time on Matthew 1, and it was about how Mary got pregnant by another man other than Joseph. And that's why Joseph wanted to divorce her. He knew she'd been screwing around with somebody else. And then the angel came and announced to Joseph in Matthew 1, don't divorce her, because this child that will be born will be holy. And I want you, Joseph, to give him his name. And his name will be Jesus, because he will save everyone from their sins. And so the story is, the miracle that happened here was not a biological miracle. It was a moral miracle. That this one who was born illegitimately, this one who was born in sin, and if you stretch it a little bit, you can take that line out of Galatians 3, he was born under the curse of the law. That's how he was born under the curse of the law. He was an illegitimate child. God takes this illegitimate child and says, in him will be the salvation of the world. Because you see, salvation does not come through moral rectitude. And so here, I remember one of my lines was, in the lap of a apparent heresy, we find the full gospel flourishing. Well, people were walking out of that sermon. I didn't even get because you see, I failed the litmus test, didn't I? So why hang around and listen to the bozo preach? He's not a Christian. He's not a Christian. Because he does not hold all the true doctrines. And lest, you know, we laugh too much at that, you know, we these days, some of us, Lutherans anyway, are talking about a new church, and it's painfully obvious to us that this, in some ways, is a complete sham, because the Missouri Synod of the Lutheran Church is not participating. And we try to kind of ignore them or whatever. But here we've got a group that are not participating. Why? Because the true doctrines are not being held. It's a serious consideration. And I think the same thing can happen in our Sunday schools. We talked a little bit about education yesterday. You know, what is education about? Is it this true doctrine? Making sure the kids got it all straight. And then we talked a little bit about Garrison Keillor's monologue on confirmation that was out a couple months ago. He says, what a sham, you know, we have these little kids stand up there, give memorized answers to questions that baffled theologians for centuries, the likes of Aquinas, and they give them in 5 minutes, plus it's memorized. They can memorize the answer. So this thing about knowledge collapsing into the faith, he wanted to drive a wedge in there. Not say that the Christian knows nothing, not say that doctrine's not important, but that it's not the most important thing. Not the most important thing. Instead, the most important thing is running this risk of identifying yourself with the one absolute in life, and that is God. As we know God in Jesus, for Kierkegaard, the way he kind of worked that. And to identify with that, and to struggle with that relationship, and the basic thing in that relationship for Kierkegaard is an offense. And living with that offense. And what's offensive about that relationship with God is that the law that comes from God is too much to bear. And the gospel that comes is too little to help at all. The gospel's, you're forgiven. I want more than that. Fix everything. I don't want to have to suffer anymore. I don't want to get a fix like this again. Give me some bumper pads. Save me from suffering. Inner turmoil, doubt. I want my life to be one of unmitigated success. If that can't get that out of forgiveness, keep the forgiveness, give me all the rest. The gospel's not enough. The gospel's not enough. It's offensive. It's not just the law that offends us for Kierkegaard. It's the gospel that offends us as well. There's no safe place. So you get in this relationship with the absolute, God as seen in Jesus, your life is going to be filled with this offense. Now for him, there's a backside to that, and there's a joy that comes out of that. But the primary thing is you have to pass through that school of the offensiveness of it all. That's another wedge. Today we're going to look at the wedge. Start today and tomorrow. The fourth wedge, the last wedge. Thank God it's the last one. And we get on to something more pleasant. We'll go on a hike. The fourth wedge is a wedge being drawn, being driven between the Christian faith and community. Dare we say it here in these hallowed places? The quintessence of community. Kierkegaard wants to drive a wedge between the Christian faith and community. Not a hacksaw. He doesn't want to break it apart and say community has no place in the Christian faith whatsoever. We're all isolated. Isolated creatures suffering with this offensive God. No, that's not all there is. There is community. And it's important. But it's not the center. It's not the center. So he's driving a wedge here because in his day he saw a collapse. He saw a collapse. He saw the Christian faith being identified with life in the community. Rollo May in our day, who apparently was very close to Paul Tillich, has a critique of Tillich's book, Courage to Be. Tillich's book, Courage to Be, in many ways very Kierkegaardian. And Rollo May's critique in his little book on creativity said that, really, that's not the arduous calling from the Christian faith, the courage to be. Actually, the arduous calling is the courage to belong. Tillich had it wrong, so did Kierkegaard. The most important thing, really, is belonging. And everything else will come. There's a magic in belonging. You can belong to a community with all kinds of defects in your character, and they will have the best chance ever of being corrected. The power of the community. Kierkegaard saw something like that going on in his day. He saw it through the business about infant baptism. Bothered him immensely. Because there the whole rush was, you know, and we still have it today. People come calling up. We're a member of First Lutheran Church West Seattle. Oh, really? Huh. Gosh, you know, I've been here 7 years, never heard it. Well, look it up. Hey, you have an inactive members list. I'm probably there. Oh, yes. Oh, well, what can we, you know, what's up? Well, we've had a child. We want to get them fixed, you know. We want to have this thing. We want to get it done. We want to get it, you know, get it over with. We got to get them baptized. Get them in to the flock so everything's safe. Kierkegaard saw a similar thing going on in the state church in Denmark, where the thing that was the most important was that you get hooked into the community and that you belong. That you belong. There's a safety in belonging. Kierkegaard found that to be reprehensible. Reprehensible. You lose your soul when it goes that way. Now, so he then penned this series of newspaper articles that are collected in this book with the lovely title, Attack Upon Christendom. The new translation that's coming out of this book is not having this title. It probably doesn't sell well. You know, Attack Upon Christendom. Maybe it does sell. Depends on who your audience is, I suppose, or something. Got to get that book. I've been wanting to do that for a long time. Didn't have enough ammo. There's probably a lot of ammo in here. But the new translation is going to be called The Moment. The Moment. Which I guess is the name out of one of the papers in which these articles appeared. But there Kierkegaard wanted to say, well, you see, so people saw when he's driving this wedge that it's not a wedge, it's a hacksaw. He may even be coming with a wedge, you know, he's got a sledgehammer going, but actually he's got a hacksaw in his back pocket. Because once he gets it apart, he's going to cut it away and eliminate the community altogether. That is the suspicion. And there are things that he says that make it sound like that. But again, we have to try to remember, if it seems right to us, try to remember that behind all four of these wedges, there is this interest in the individual. And it's not a narcissistic individualism that he's talking about. An individualism where the reason why I am trying to maintain the integrity of the individual is so that I can become the best consumer possible. Be narcissistic. Have all my needs met. That's why we want to protect the individual. To make sure we get everything that we want. This kind of, inward looking individualism. That's not what he was interested in. He may not have been successful, but that's not what he was interested in. He was interested in what might be called a potentiated individualism, where he was interested in being able to isolate the individual so that strength and character and courage emerges. Self-awareness, this is what I am. I am something. You know, that business that Jesse Jackson does, you are somebody. That part of Jesse Jackson seems to me to be Kierkegaardian. Okay? I don't want to, glomp on to Jesse Jackson's achievements and have that somehow validate what Kierkegaard's up to. But that theme about you are somebody. Why? So that you have a strength, an inner strength. For what? For what? Well, being in relation to the absolute, God, but also, albeit for Kierkegaard, secondarily, to contribute to a community. Otherwise, the community just caves in on itself. If you have the community made up of people who, in Kierkegaard's vocabulary, we'll look at it, are not qualitative individuals, then the community is for naught. It's a sham. It's an illusion. So that's why he's driving this wedge. Even though it was controversial at the time, I think it's still controversial now. Let's grant him his intentions. He doesn't pull it off. Let's see if he pulls it off. We'll look at a couple passages here. And then I hope most of you got the thing on the church. We'll look at that. Let me just identify a couple in this book, and then we'll go to that passage, that collection from the journals. 286, towards the end of the book, I think is one of the more revealing passages. That first full paragraph, which just is one little sentence, it goes, "With the years, it is true, this pain diminishes more and more, for as more and more one becomes spirit," being spiritual, in this, that's a euphemism for Kierkegaard in being in aligned with what the Christian faith is about. Being aligned. "The more you become spirit, it causes no pain that one is not like others. Spirit precisely is this, not to be like others." We looked at one of the early journal articles, journal entries last week, where Kierkegaard says that he's talking about Marx in a veiled way and kind of chiming in with him. It's controversial whether or not Kierkegaard really knew Marx or had read any of it. But he's bemoaning the fact of the rise of the industrial society and that everything is being produced in mass quantity. And he's worried about Christians being produced in mass quantity, kind of being stamped out. And he said, that can't be. That is to depart from Christianity because the God of the faith detests mimicry. Detests mimicry. Therefore, this God works to produce creativity and diversity. And that's coming out again here in this late article where he says, spirit precisely is this, not to be like others. You have to have a strong internal constitution not to get sucked into the crowd. Sociologists talk about the herd instinct. Want to be like others. It's really quite remarkable how that goes. It flowers, I suppose, in our youth. Peer pressure and all that. We get used to wanting to be accepted and, everybody wears clothes the same as everybody else, I can remember in my adolescence, the get-ups that we had, back in the late 50s, early 60s, and it was, you're all trying to look alike. Why? Well, we want to be accepted. We want to be a part of a group. For Kierkegaard, that, if you're not very, very careful, spells the end of spirit. Spirit, again, being that which detests mimicry, promotes diversity and creativity. It's a hell of a thing for an organizer. Right? You want to organize people. You don't want all these creative, diverse people. We joke about it, you know, I got too many engines, you know, that racist remark we have, you know, we need more followers. We got too many chiefs, we need more engines. That's the way it goes, you know. Well, gee, that's the way the church is. I don't want my people to be potentiated. I don't want them to be strong, diverse, creative. Because I've got too many programs I'm responsible for. I've got to be sure that I got people lined up to do those things. If, you know, we get together again, well, gee, we've had the soup kitchen going on for 3 weeks, you know, and we got these people lined up, say, you know, how's it look for next week? I'm going to Nicaragua. That's where I'm going. You can't go to Nicaragua. We've got the soup kitchen. We've got to work. I don't know. I've got to go to Nicaragua. Or two of my pastor friends in Seattle, Tom Soldren and Red Birchfield, they had to go to South Africa. You can't go to South Africa now. We got all these things we're working on in the Seattle area with the churches. These guys were key leaders. I don't know. I'm going to South Africa. Why are you going? I just got to go. Why do you got to go? I don't know, but we're going. Taking the whole kit and caboodle, the whole works. So they take their family. You can't take your family. They may die. I know, but we've got to go. That just is rotten for an organizer. When you've got people, when you've got that kind of diversity, that kind of creativity, those free spirits, see? The herd mentality just works wonders for organizers. Those of you here who have organized, you just love it when people step with it, you know, get with it, get in the line. Oh, look at, they're all in the line. You know, there we go, man, you know. So see, you know, what are the, you know, Kierkegaard, we're going to look at this, his little thing on the church. He said, I will always be viewed as an impractical exaggeration. That's putting it mildly, isn't it? But that's it, you see, especially on this business of wanting there to be that kind of creativity, diversity, the detesting of mimicry. So you see, it looks like you're not going to have a community, right? I mean, if you've got all these free-spirited people flying around wherever, you know, the spirit blows them, how are you going to ever get everybody together? It's like in our family, you know, we were talking recently about why can't we ever have a supper together? Everybody's just kind of flying all around. The schedules are so wild and crazy. If we do eat together, it's kind of in this amalgamation of shifts that are within the same time period of half an hour or 45 minutes. We're actually not all sitting down, you know. How do you get everybody together? There, it's not because we're so creative and everything, but it's other problems. But you got that same kind of a feeling with Kierkegaard here. How are you going to get all these creative, diverse people together to test mimicry? How are you going to get them all together to stand up at the same time to confess the one creed? So, you know, maybe it's kind of suspicious, isn't it? If he's really able to pull it off. But that's a key passage there. Key in the sense that he really shows his hand there on page 286. Look at page 247, another thing here. This is where he kind of starts hitting below the belt. He didn't think he was doing that right. 247, he says, therefore, deceive not thyself. Of all deceivers, fear most thyself. Even if it were possible in relation to the eternal, to God, to take something in advance, thou wouldst yet be deceiving thyself by something in advance, and then an eternity in which to repent. Be very suspicious on why you want to belong, why you want to be part of a community. Be very suspicious of it, because it may be, he would say, it inevitably is a distraction. You're in a community so you can distract yourself from the problem that's right there between your shoulders. See? You get into a community and you get distracted by dealing with everybody else, And what you've left is the problem that's there between your shoulders. Dealing with yourself. Paul Homer teaches at Yale Divinity School. He's been there for a number of years. He's one of the leading Kierkegaardians in America. He published a book about 10 years ago called The Grammar of Faith. And in the preface to the book, you know, most people in the book, they thank everybody it helped him. He starts, but he says, I wrote this book all by myself. All right. I'm going to read more of this. He says, yeah, he said, I just holed up in a little room, had some books around me, and sat down. I wrote this book all by myself. So that's the way it's supposed to be done. You're supposed to write all by myself, all by yourself. And if there's somebody you don't like, it's my fault. You talk to me about it. I did it all by myself. There is a strong desire in us not to be all by ourselves, to deflect that kind of thing. I know in working in my parish with people who want to get married, you know, talking about why you want to get married, what's going on here with the two of you, why would you like to wreck a good relationship? That's what I'm at. And one of the things that comes up a lot is being lonely. I'm lonely. Very lonely. I don't know. There's a sense in which I'm sure that being lonely is awful. But if it is, if that fear of being lonely is actually a fear of being alone, there's such a distinction between being lonely and alone. And if finally what that is a fear of dealing with myself. Again, you remember, lurking behind Kierkegaard, Socrates. The unexamined life is not worth living. That's in Kierkegaard. As much as Luther is in Kierkegaard, Socrates is there. The unexamined life isn't worth living. If you can make that kind of a distinction between lonely and alone, and if the fear of being alone is a fear of examining yourself. Now, I know what the fear for me is in examining myself, is that I'm going to look within and find nothing. Not so much look within and find something I don't like. I'm going the wrong direction. But look in there and I don't see any direction. If that's what it is, then you know what we need to do? We've got to get some kind of a promotion going on being alone. We've got to be advocates of being alone. You need to spend more time on yourself alone. Dealing with who you are, working on that all by yourself. What do you think? What do you see in me? What do you like? What do you think are my strengths or my weaknesses? How can I fix this thing? What do you think? God knows you've got a better perspective on me than I do. I mean, I'm with myself all the time, and I can't be trusted, right? And Kierkegaard would say that too, wouldn't he? He said, Be careful of how you're going to deceive yourself. Okay. But the importance of being Robert Bly, the Minnesota poet, talks about, and it must be a luxurious life. But he lives out on a farm there by Moose Lake in Minnesota. And months of each year, he spends alone in a little shack some 30 miles away from the farm. And he goes up there on periods, extended periods. I'm not quite sure if I got the story, but I think they're like sections of 6-8 weeks where he's in that look all by himself. Think of it, will you? I'm an urbanite, and that scares the shit out of me. What am I saying? What if I had a heart attack? I couldn't call medic one. That's not the only thing, right? There are more things. There I am. I mean, I don't have Bach to listen to. What would I do? What would I do? 6 weeks all by myself with this little thing? Okay. Well, Bly argues that what happens to you is that you learn how to be a poet then. The only reason we don't have more poets is we don't have time to be alone. And then it's a matter of just trying to keep up with the poems that are coming out of himself and be able to write them down. Well, again, I press that thing, but awfully luxurious. I can just see myself trying to convince Jane, I want to be alone for 6 weeks. Every 2 weeks, I'll come, after, you know, I'll be alone 6 weeks, and I'll come back for 2 weeks. And then I'll be alone again for 6 weeks. You can clean all the mess, change all the diapers, take care of everything. I'll be alone for 6 weeks. It's good for my soul, you understand. I mean, it looks a little, you know, strange. But the business, one thing I like about that is, I don't know if it did it to you, but it does it to me every time I think about it, when I kind of get, in looking at it kind of purely, or whatever, the fright that comes upon me to think about being by myself for that long. Does it scare you? And I'm one who longs to be by myself. You know, I don't get enough time to read, you know, so I just have one or two more hours a day. So I want to, they're saying, how about 6 weeks all by yourself? Oh, no. Okay, that's part of what he's getting into, this thing with him about the church, okay, and being part of the group and the herd mentality. Okay, and so he says, of all deceivers, fear most thyself. And what's the deception here? Why do you want to be a part of it? Why do you want to get married? Why do you want to belong? Do you want to belong because you're afraid of yourself? Is that what it is? Let me change my focus of attention onto all these people who are around me. And don't look at myself. Is that why? That's his suspicion. That's his suspicion. We're going to look at a few more things, but let's move to this little sheet. This is a remarkable first entry here from 1850. This is a few years before the book was written that we're looking at now. Entry 4175. In order to describe where it is to be found, I know of nothing more illuminating than an analogy which in certain respects is without comparison. The world of crime forms a little society of its own, lying on the other side of human society. A little society which ordinarily also has an intimate solidarity not altogether common in the world, perhaps also because each one individually feels expelled from human society. This means that the Christian congregation is a society consisting of qualitative individuals, and that the intimacy of the society is also conditioned by this polemical stance against the great human society. For Kierkegaard, the model of the church is a band of criminals. That's something. A band of criminals. And what does he like about that analogy? He likes three things I see there. One is that it's a bunch of qualitative individuals. Okay? These criminals. Now you might say, well, they may be qualitative individuals, but they're all going to hell in a handbasket. He doesn't worry about that value specification. The things he likes about it is that this band of criminals, they're qualitative individuals. They've all kind of been through it. They've been through the fires of trials. Okay? And the basic one there for them is this thing about being rejected from the basic society. They feel left out. Okay? So the first thing is the qualitative individual. The second thing he likes about it is the polemical stance. They're left out. They feel over against the society. It's not that we're, you know, part of the great mesh. Yeah?
I don't understand the word polemical.
Well, that's the thing about standing against critically, being over against it and saying, if I have a political relationship to my society, is that I do not see that I belong there. I don't even see that it's good that I should belong there. I'm critical of my society, negative about it.
Political is a negative stance.
Yes, a negative stance, a negative critical stance. Okay, and then what's the third thing he sees here that he likes? This is the surpriser for me. The solidarity. The intimacy. See, he's intentionally, he's not opposed to it. You may say he can't pull it off. But intentionally, he wants there to be intimacy and solidarity. He just, finally, what it comes down to, I believe, he doesn't want to get the cart before the horse. An intimate community is fine if the self has emerged prior to the belonging to the community. Now, that's contrary to a lot that we have received from our Christian tradition. Why am I a member of a Christian community? It's so my faith will be strengthened, I say. You say that? It's good for me to worship regularly It's good for me to stand up with everyone and confess the faith together. There's this feeling of solidarity and strength, and in my unbelief, somehow the faith of my brothers and sisters are holding me up. The whole business about eating the bread and the wine together, we say there's a community in that, a communion, where I not only experience an intimacy with the Lord of that supper, but I also experience an intimacy with my brothers and sisters who are eating from the same loaf and drinking from the same cup. Provided we've solved the problems about whether or not you can get AIDS from doing that. AIDS just about wrecked our communion practices in our church, but thank God for the New England Journal of Medicine. No, some knowledge helps, see. But, so there was an article in there about that you can't transmit it through saliva, and everybody thought that was convincing them. But here you are. See, so there is this connect. So, I mean, you know, why am I belonging? It looks like I'm belonging for the reasons that Kierkegaard says you should never belong. So I find these words to be very angular, very out of step with my inclinations. I look at the community to strengthen me and make me an individual. Holden Village has that reputation. There are people in our congregation, and I say, well, you know, you should have seen me before I spent 6 years at Holden Village. I was a real mess. But I went to Holden Village and I spent 6 years there. And now I'm okay. I was all screwed up when I went there. Well, what are you telling me? Well, I'm telling you there's a power in a community. If you can find a community that's supportive and strong and helpful, you can grow in a community and become an individual. You should have seen me before I went there. I was a basket case. I just went from one high to another. There's a fellow in our church. I like him a lot. And that's what was with him. He had severe drug problems, and he came up here and got straightened out. Holden Village saved him. He was nothing. He came here, he became something. So that's in. I mean, you hear reports like that. Some of you probably would say, same. So to hear Kierkegaard say, you got the cart before the horse, it seems counterintuitive. It seems just contrary to what's this deep thing inside of us. But he seems to identify something that's very, very deep, so he argues. And it's not something that comes to our recollection readily. So he pushes for it. Let's look at a couple more of these, and then we'll try to open it up a little more. To finish that one. But when, in the course of time, and in the steady advance of nonsense, it turned out that to be a Christian is synonymous with being a human being, then the Christian congregation became the race. Good night, Ole! Oh, carried away himself there. The Christian congregation became the human race. The next one, let a few of us get together in a group. Makes life easier and more comfortable, so on. I have nothing against anyone choosing to do so for this reason, the reason being it makes life easier. But I do oppose the mendacity, the lie, the deceit, which has turned the whole thing around and made being an individual into fanaticism, into untruth, and the like, but has made togetherness, the easier life, into truth, into the highest. So that's the cart before the horse business. He has nothing against this. Let a few of us get together in a group. Fine, but just don't say it's the best. It's a funny kind of maneuver. It's the kind of maneuver that we see going on in Luke 10 when Jesus' disciples come back and he says that you're going to have power over everything. Nothing's going to hurt you. You're going to have all this authority. So they go out and they come back and guess what we have been doing? We have been handling snakes and scorpions and that whole thing and walking on coals of fire and we have not been hurt. We rejoice. And Jesus, what does he say to them? He says, wonderful, wonderful, but don't rejoice in it. What? He doesn't deny that it happened and he didn't deny it was wonderful. Yes, you did that. You didn't get hurt. You had that power, and it's what? But don't rejoice in it. What? Why wouldn't one rejoice over something as wonderful as that? Don't rejoice in it, he says. Rejoice instead in this, that your names are written in heaven. You gotta be kidding. I mean, just after this display of great power and achievement, you're just intoxicated by it, he said. It's wonderful. I don't deny it happened, but don't rejoice in it. Rejoice instead, your names are written in heaven. Right? God's earthly name, rejoice in that. You know, it's that kind of a deflecting. Kierkegaard seems to be doing that same kind of deflect. He's not denying that there should be community. He's not denying that it's important. He just says, don't say it's the highest. And the tendency would be to say it's the highest. Then this section on individual. The single individual is a category which may be used in two ways. This, I think, is a very important entry in Kierkegaard's journals. It's a change in his view. And in a way, my whole thing here is a misnomer, saying Kierkegaard's corrective. Because then you see, the corrective only works when there's something to be fixed. If things get okay, then there's no need for the corrective anymore. So a lot of folk, that's like the opening thing last week, and I was talking about Kierkegaard. Chuck Lutz said, you know, why are people reading Kierkegaard again? He seems to come and go. You know, they read him in the 50s, don't read him anymore. Now they seem to be reading him again. Is there a renaissance? I said, well, that's Holden Village. You know, we're making this big attempt to read Kierkegaard again. I said, well, this one, Martin Heineken tells a story about a fellow who said, you only read Kierkegaard when you're constipated. Kierkegaard's a laxative. If you're not constipated, you don't read them. It can kill you, right? If you're not constipated, you're taking laxatives all over the place, you know, it's going to finish you off, won't it? So it looks like Kierkegaard only works when there's a particular problem, a constipation, to bring, you know, correction. He's a laxative. This, and Kierkegaard thought that of himself earlier on. Now this entry, getting towards the end of his life, he wants to see it working as a double-edged sword in any situation. Now he says that the single individual is a category that may be used in two ways. One for constipation and the other one for great times of regularity. You can use them both ways. In times when security prevails and existence seems to lie under a spell of apathy, the single individual is the category of awakening. That's the laxative. In agitated times when everything is tottering, the single individual is the category of composure. Look at that. The person who understands how to use this category will feel quite different in times of peace than in times of commotion. And yet he will be using the same weapon. The difference is the same as that between using a sharp and pointed instrument like a scalpel to wound and using the same instrument to clean out a wound. So this business about the individual and having the church be this collection of a band of criminals, these people who stand in a polemical relationship over against the society at large, these people who have solidarity, who come as qualitative individuals, not expecting the community to make them a person, but looking at the community as an opportunity for solidarity and intimacy and exchange. Robert Bly also tells a story about Neruda, the great Mexican poet. And he tells a story that what a wonderful thing it was when they were in jail, he was being jailed all the time, that when a new poet came into the jail, it was great. Because this tradition of poems was that poems aren't something you read, but you memorize them. And so that you can just tell the poem from your heart. And so when the new poet would come in, being jailed for his civil disobedience, here came a whole new volume of poems. It was great. So you got to hear a whole new repertoire of poems, because that one had all the poems that he or she had memorized. And it's that kind of a thing, see, that kind of solidarity and intimacy, the sharing of between qualitative individuals, see. That person doesn't show up in the jail and say, make me a poet. That kind of a, okay. So, and the difference is the same as that between using a sharp and pointed instrument, like a scalpel to wound, and using the same instrument to clean out the wound. One is awakening, the wounding, and the other is the composure, the cleaning out of the wound. And so then he can say quite bald-faced in the next one, not as one who enthusiastically proclaims Christianity, but as a dialectician does it, in Socratically starving the life out of all the illusions in which Christendom has run aground. That's what it is, to starve the life out of the illusions. And that's part of the reason for driving this wedge in between community and Christianity. There's an illusion there, he says. And he wants to starve the life out of it. And the illusion is that you become an individual by being, by belonging, rather than you become an individual by being alone, and then you enter into the community. And so he says, my task has never been to bring down the established order. That's where he's different than Marx. But constantly to infuse inwardness into it. That's the business about being alone and examining yourself. That's the infusing of inwardness. Okay? It's becoming acquainted with yourself and building a self. And then his famous statement that's so kind of self-revealing. I've talked to some about this before, and they say he kind of sounds like Richard Nixon. You don't have me to kick around anymore. You know, it's kind of complaining about himself. Frequently I find something sad in the fact that I, with all my capabilities, must always stand outside as a superfluity and in practical exaggeration. But the whole thing is very simple. Conditions are still far from being confused enough for proper use to be made of me. But it will end. And they shall see, with conditions getting so desperate that they must make use of desperate people like me and my kind. So if it is an absolutely harebrained notion to say that the Christian church should be based on the analogy of a band of criminals, I mean, really, get with it, Marshall. My congregation is made up of orthodontists. Internists. Bank presidents. School teachers. Professors. Lawyers. Accountants. And I stand there and say, what we need is a congregation made up of a band of criminals. That's it. Criminals.
What happened?
Oh, I take 2 weeks off and go to Olden Village. You know? I mean, it looks really very impractical. And it's an exaggeration, isn't it? It's an exaggeration, isn't it? It's an exaggeration, isn't it? Isn't it? But he's looking at it a little differently, isn't he? The polemical stance over against society. It's a different sense of being a criminal. You are right. That's kind of looping. Before God, we're all beggars. We're all kind of sinners, criminals. But he puts it, he frames it really in a social way, doesn't he? Having this polemical stance over against society. And I think it's because there's a deception that may creep in for us there. I can say that line of Luther's, before God I'm a beggar, and then find great security in the fact that I am landed gentry. I've been talking about this week about myself being landed gentry, and Ruth is so sick of that, she's now calling me Archibald. Well, Archibald, landed gentry, well, we are. I mean, I do not feel disenfranchised for my society. I fit. Can you believe it? But I mean, I got that feeling. You know, I got money in my pocket. I've got a job, just for the time being. I've checked back in my Seattle. I got a job, schooling. I'm educated. You know, all that kind of thing. I come from a family that's, you know, the mainstream of America and all that. You know, brothers and sisters. You know, there's no poverty in my family. You know, there hasn't been for generations. I mean, I fit. I'm landed. Thing. And so I can say, well, before God, I'm a beggar. Nice. But I, you know, kind of cute, isn't it, actually? I always want to know what it was like to be a beggar. Before God, I'm a beggar. But I'm not a beggar. I'm not a beggar. Here it says, you better be a beggar. You better get a polemical stance over against your society. Or else your society is your God. Okay, I have another little ditty to hand out here, but I don't have enough of them, and I'm sick and tired of cutting up these damn things. But in this one little ditty, he has a thing, another thing he likes about Luther. You know what I like about Luther, he says? Luther said that the church was a despised little flock of sheep. A despised little flock, and the Pope and all the rest of the church are not the church. But it's that despised little flock.
Is this Luther saying this?
Luther says that, and Kierkegaard says, I like it. I like it. The church is a despised... Luther was entirely correct. I'll read the line. Luther was entirely correct in referring to the true church as a despised little flock. The Pope and all that are not the true church. What is this, you know, how does this strike you? All this stuff.
I had the same problem yesterday.
Yeah.
You are justified by being offensive, different, suspicious, alone, desperate, inward, rejecting society. You're justified. That's what I hear. It's kind of loud and clear. And I don't believe Luther would have accepted your justification for being rejecting society or accepting. Being different or the same. You can't be justified by being the same or by being different. You're not justified by any particular stance toward anything. I mean, you can't be justified by the no. These are all no's, I think. They're like Karl Barth in his first period. No, no, no. The question is, what's the yes?
Well, if I could add something there. The problem in Kierkegaard says that the great sin that you sin against yourself is looking to another to give your identity to you. You see, he has this little story, I think it's in Sixth Son of Death, about the woman who's engaged to be married to this man. And she spends the period of betrothal imagining what life will be like with this person, how great it'll be to live in this house, to have the children, to approach old age together. And then the young man dies suddenly. And then she goes to the grave, and she curses this person whom she loved because he has thrown her back upon herself. She can no longer look to him to grant her identity. And it isn't so much that it's a no, 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 this kind of inwardness thing. It's just that you can't look to another to give you your identity, whether it's your husband, your wife, or society.
Well, you look to God, of course.
Sure.
I mean, that's obvious. It frees you from everything.
And that throws you back upon yourself. And that's what Kierkegaard says, that's the offense. We don't want to be thrown back upon ourselves.
It also frees you from having to reject everything. You don't have to reject everything, except reject everything to justify yourself, including rejection.
But you have to be in a critical dialectic relationship with society around you. Otherwise, you'll be absorbed into. Another point he says, you'll just become like one more smooth pebble thrown upon the beach. Indistinguishable from every other pebble upon that beach. In order to be the individual, you have to remain jagged and broken and acceptable to that kind of an individual existence. And if you can't willing to do that, then life, society will just rub you smooth and toss you upon the beach. And there you'll be.
You have to be free to accept other people. Don't just reject it.
Sure.
If
you can't work with who you are first, then what does your acceptance of another person mean? It means nothing. It means nothing.
It's a price against culture position. It's an absolute which has to be undermined for the sake of a positive.
To simply mimic another person or to mimic society and then say, in my mimicry, I accept you, that's an empty statement for Kierkegaard. Empty.
You don't mimic society. You find in society positive things. You don't accept society because it's society. You make your individual judgment that there are things in society which are good, and you identify with them. You don't have to be against everything.
Well, he wouldn't object to that.
Okay.
He's simply a dialectic. It's not a radical arsonist approach to society. It's a dialectic.
But I think
He doesn't want to bring down the established order, he says. Right. He wants to infuse inwardness into it.
But you get a sense that you are offensive for the sake of being offensive. And that is not where I could see it.
No, no, he doesn't say that. I think he's taking offensive too literal a category there. He just means that being
that's
an individual.
What I hear from Ryan, in a way, is justification for being offensive, different, no problem being the same, if the same is worth being the same. You don't have to be different. You know, you don't have to be different if to be the same is where you are, and that's what you think we ought to be. If you had two kindergartens, wouldn't they be the same?
He's not saying be the same. He's saying being an individual.
Same stance, though? Same general?
Well, the band of criminals. So you can't get the criminals together.
But they all reject society.
Well, they have a polemical stance, he says, which is not, I mean, there is that. That's not quite as clean, sweet, as a complete rejection of society.
They wouldn't reject each other because they all reject something.
Jesse Jackson has a polemical stance over against society, doesn't he? But he works in it. But I would say he has a polemical stance. He's identifying the things that the where it's going the wrong way, and he applauds the things that are going the right way. Now, some people say it would have to be somebody like Jesse Jackson to be able to see that, because in some sense, he's a criminal. He's a disenfranchised person, in some sense, being a black person in this society, with our history, what we've done with black people. So he can see, he's a qualitative individual emerging into the solidarity very selectively with the society. I worry about making those kinds of moves because it's taking credibility from one camp and trying to baptize another one, but I'm wondering if it's that kind of a sense of being the polemical stance. So it's not just a no, 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 no about everything. Well, yeah, and it's hard to be an individual then. It's hard to be an individual because you're co-opted. There's no model, you know. Bly had an article in the New York Times Book Review about being a poet. I don't know if some of you may have seen that. He said it's impossible in this society. There's no models. It's the weirdest sort of a thing. So you say, and what the bother was for him is you don't know what to fight for and what not to fight for when you don't have a model. So you're always kind of crafting it on yourself. Crafting it, working it out yourself. Just to say a couple things to Al, the first thing I want to say is that I think Kierkegaard's self-understanding, even though I may be misrepresenting it, is that this does not justify one. Okay? For him, I think he believed there's a difference between being a Christian and following Jesus. You can be a Christian and not follow Jesus. He really thought that was possible. He called it a burlesque abridgment. But it was Christian because you're Christian by grace. That's the book Self for Self-Examination. Right at the front, up front in that book, he declares that. He says, it's madness, but I believe it's true. Yeah. And then he wants to, he just goes with a vengeance after this following Jesus, what this following Jesus means. And for there, it is a matter of taking a stand. Something is right and something is wrong. And we don't want to get in the position, I remember in the 60s, when I was in college, we went to our, and said, you got to quit doing military experimentations here because through that you are supporting the war in Vietnam. And they said, no, we take no stand on the war in Vietnam. We're neither for it or against it. We said, you are for it by aiding and abetting the military work. They say, no, we are not. And that story was repeated all over the country in the 60s, right? And the university is saying, we are neutral. Okay. So I worry about, you know, saying you're not justified by saying no, you're not justified by saying yes. See, I mean, there's a place to take a stand, but you got to be very careful that that's not connected with justification. Or else the whole thing falls down according to his self-understanding. Now, it may have all fallen down. He may not have pulled it off.